So, this morning, I didn't know whether to look at a new case or to spend some time with some old friends. Accordingly, case 96 of the Book of Serenity, Jufeng's disagreement. Jufeng worked as an attendant of Shishuang. When Shishuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the first-ranked monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Jufeng did not agree. He said, "Wait until I have questioned him. If he understands our late teacher's meaning, I'll serve him like our late teacher." Then he asked the chief monk. The late teacher said, "Cease, desist, spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees. Be a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. Now tell me, which side does this illustrate?" The chief monk said, "It illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Jufeng said, "Then you still don't understand the late teacher's meaning." The chief monk said, "You don't agree with me. Set up some incense." The chief monk then lit incense and said, "If I don't understand the late teacher's meaning, then I won't be able to pass away while this incense is still burning." So saying, he sat down and died. Jufeng then caressed his shoulder and said, "As far as dying seated or standing is concerned, you're not lacking. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it." Hong Zhe's verse. This is the same Hong Zhe who we read today in the service. The school of Shishuang was personally transmitted to Jufeng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. The crane nesting on the moon has a 1,000-year dream. The man in the snowy room is deluded by the achievement of oneness. Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step and behold a flying dragon. One of the commenters in the Book of Serenity, whose name escapes me at the moment, points out when Jufeng asked the head monk his question, if the head monk had said, "I don't see what you see," he would have given Jufeng no room to fit his body and made him submit with all his heart. And don't imagine that submit is a aggressive domination. This is a they would have met each other. And I want to hold up this matter of seeing it how we see it. Meeting this moment of enoughness. And again, underscore that it is not, in a really important way, this practice, though profoundly, profoundly, profoundly liberating. This practice is not about you. The liberation is real. The practice is real. But it isn't as Shohaku Okumura told us in the reading we did today. It is not the I, the limited karmic self, that awakens to reality. Rather, it is the reality of the universe that is itself practicing and manifesting reality. The liberation is real, but you don't get to have it. And the limited karmic self, this is the self whose mental formations arise because of causes and conditions. This is the self that myriad causes, myriad conditions from the ancient, ancient past, all impinging onto this moment. Unknowably so. The fact of them is certain. The specifics of them wholly unknowable. But it is not the limited karmic self that experiences. Liberation is not a thing experienced by the limited karmic self. The limited karmic self is only ever the limited karmic self. And in Zazen, we entrust this limited karmic self to the total interpenetrating whole that is absolute reality. And this absolute reality can never be an object of consciousness, because consciousness is too small a vessel, too conditional a vessel. It's not separate from what arises, but it's never contained in what arises. In the verse to this case, Hongzhi points to something really beautiful. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. And the true bloodline, the bloodline of the Buddhas and ancestors, is the awakened truth of this Dharma. And it's actually also the name of one of the documents transmitted in Denkai, Dharma transmission. Passing on this bloodline, passing on the entrusting the forms, the skillful means, entrusting the curatorship of the Dharma to another being in the service of all beings, is really important. And just to pause for a moment and appreciate that this form of Sesshin, this practice of Shikantaza, this practice of retreat, this practice of meeting teachers, liturgy, bowing, koans, these have been cared for by generations and generations and generations of our ancestors in the Dharma, passed on through generations and generations and generations. For hundreds of years, some for thousands of years. So that we today can come and sit in the reality that it's not about us. So this business of it's not the limited karmic self that awakens. This has been very important to me. And we've been appreciating the practice of failure. We've been appreciating all week that matter. And for me, one of the most comforting and liberating things came when I so I always had a sense that fundamentally at the deepest levels of things, it was very clear to me from the beginning that I was totally fucked. This was the bedrock realization. And I had a sense, about, you know, what I imagined, you know, these people who write these Dharma books, these meditation manuals, the ancestors, what I imagined they were able to do. And it was so clear to me that whatever that is, it's not a thing I can do. And yet, I really love the Dharma. And the Dharma is, you know, so dear to my heart and is so life-saving for me, even though I fail continually. And one of the things that was most transformative for me was when I encountered a teacher who is a contemporary of Dogen. His name was Shinran. Not a Zen teacher, a teacher from the a different school. And Shinran basically clarified for me that the reason that I totally feel like I'm fucked, and the reason that I totally feel like I can't do it, is because I'm fucked. And I can't do it. And I found that kind of so validating, so including of my actual experience. And so one thing that's really important to see about this business of trying to do it, whatever you're trying to do, whatever in Shikan Taza you're trying to do, it's really important to see that that trying, that volitional formation of intending, of aiming, of attempting, is just another arising, is just another example of a too small vessel to hold it. And some of you have heard me talk about one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons, in which one guy on a street corner is enthusiastically talking to another guy, and he's saying, "And then I realized failure is an option." And when Failing is what's arising. Failing is an option. And to imagine it's not an option is to really profoundly cut ourselves off from an important part of our lives, an important part of the experience of being human. One of my favorite lines in this long piece we read this morning: even amid delusion, we are still living within absolute universal reality. And even though we are living within absolute universal reality, we are still deluded as limited karmic selves. And it's the next sentence that is my favorite. This is the reality of human life. This mess, this delusion after delusion arising, because that's delusion is a name for the things that arise. Delusion isn't the name of the crappy things that arise. Delusion is a name for the two small vessels, states of consciousness, feelings, ideas, insights. Those are named delusion. And yet, there's value. This practice is very much not nothing. It's not a thing. It's not what you imagine it is. It's not for what we definitely are sure we want out of it. But it's not nothing. And part of the value of these byproducts of Zazen, byproducts such as absorptive samadhi, concentration, such as insights into emptiness, such as a idea of oneness arising. Part of the value of these, it's akin to when a lake gets very still. The wind stops. The lake is very still, settles out, and we can see down to the bottom of the lake. These insights are like seeing down to the bottom of the lake. But the point is not to always have the lake be still and calm so we can see. When we see for ourselves that base of the lake, then on a different day, a different hour, a different period of Zazen, when it's all churned up and there's wind and white water and mud stirred up and clouds and rain falling down, we still can entrust ourselves to the reality that that bottom is there. We don't have to skeptically doubt or fear that what if there's no bottom. And this entrusting ourselves, this is the practice of Zazen, entrusting ourselves to this absolute universal reality. And no no content of consciousness, no thing that you experience sometime and not some other time is it. And the great gift of Shikantaza is that we receive everything that arises into the same one category, and the name of that category is stuff that arises. And this, and when we really allow that into our heart, we don't have to scrutinize each moment of mind arising, each moment of Zazen, saying, is this it? Is this a good moment? Is this a good arising? Is this the right one? Or is that not the right one? Is this a comment about those other ones over there? Or is this the thing in itself? And we don't have to engage in any of that. And when that arises, that is fine too. And we don't have to quash any of that. But we don't have to believe that through some contrivance, some machination of mind, we can figure out whether this is the right moment that's arising or not. And one way that I think of this, you know, when we read earlier in the week, Reb Anderson, he talks about practicing in a way that Shikantaza is free from self-concern and personal gain. And free from sounds like a pretty high bar, but so I might say less concerned by self-concern. And part of the way that I, my kind of internal shorthand for this checking about how am I doing, back in the 80s, there was a sitcom on television called The Gary Shandling Show, and it began with comedian Gary Shandling always talking straight to the audience. And one of the things he would often say is, "How's my hair?" And the zazen of "How's my hair?" is what I encourage you to perhaps have less concern about. And this business of, is this it? Is this not it? How am I doing? How's it going? Is this an okay state of mind? But those other ones, those weren't good moments. Oh, what can I do about this moment? All right, this is all right. All of that is, how's my hair? How's my hair? How about now? How's my hair? I got to go see a teacher and find out how my hair is. I don't think I'm passing enough koans to really clarify how my hair is. And the invitation of Shikantaza, I think, is really beautifully expressed in this Hangzhi piece we read. And the amount of disorientation it takes and the amount of courage this practice takes is beautifully expressed. In upright practice, let go from the edge of the high cliff, not grabbing anything. In upright practice, let go from the edge of the high cliff, not grabbing anything. The ropes around your feet are severed. In wholeness that includes brokenness, that includes partialness, in that wholeness, take one step. And just when involved in deliberations, turn around from the stream of thoughts. Oars pulled in, the solitary boat drifts past without difficulty. At this time, please tell me, who would be anxious to display the eye of discrimination? And I just want to underscore, I want to underscore what this practice of Shikantaza is. It is stepping off the cliff of the known, stepping off the cliff of the familiar, stepping off the cliff of the definitely doable or not doable, and entrusting yourself to the free fall of absolute universal reality. Hangzhi says, not grabbing onto anything. And I want to add, also fine to see yourself trying to grab onto everything. You know, like Alice going down the hole and all the other stuff going with it. But just see that grabbing as grabbing and get back to the important business of falling. And one of the things that arises for humans doing this practice is the thought of, yeah, but this can't be it. This can't be it. I'm just not doing it. This isn't it. I mean, this is definitely not it, right? I mean, I'm sure this is not it. And really, really, really important to see all of those related trains of thoughts not as a special case, not as a special kind of arising, but just an arising. Not as a special kind of arising that has essential truth, that requires urgent intervention, that requires fixing. It's just an arising, just grabbing, just disorientation, just uncertainty. In another verse, Hongzhi says, "Be with this just as this. Be with that just as that. This, that." In upright practice, let go of the from the edge of the high cliff. Oars pulled in, the solitary boat drifts past without difficulty. At this time, please tell me, who would be anxious to say, "How's my hair?" So, here we move into our Sangha practice of Dharma dialogue. And I especially want to invite those of you who may not have spoken yet in any of our Dharma dialogues this week. Please come forth and know that that is a practice of service, of generosity, and of expounding the Dharma that has never before been expounded. And expounding it with your questions, with your heart, with your doubt, with your observation. Derek.
It's easy for you guys to say, you guys shave your head.
So, how's my hair?
Holly Edward Ray.
I am anxious to display my eye of practice. When I hear the word eye, I think of the word I. And it's very embarrassing to admit that I'm checking my hair constantly. It's embarrassing to admit that. I'm embarrassed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Seeing that clearly is so important. And bringing that out into the light. And this checking on the eye, this checking on the hair, is not a special kind of problem. It is not a unique kind of arising that definitively proves that we don't have it. It's just another this arising as this, another that arising as that.
Thank you. I still find, after all these years, that what brings me back to the cushion, what brings me back to sashimi, is this delusion that I can be better, that I can fix whatever is going on with me. And I hear that I hear you, and I hear all the teachers saying both, no, it's not going to, you know, I'm always going to be what I am. And yet I still bring myself back hoping that it will be otherwise. I mean, it's kind of like...
You speak up a little bit.
It's as though that delusion has the virtue of bringing me. It's
Yeah. 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 Good. And, you know, as this recitation says, no matter how hard we practice, our motivation for practice is always based in some amount of self-centeredness. The act of seeing the self-centeredness is itself Buddha. To awaken to the reality of our delusion is itself Buddha. And so, practice Dharma. So all of these teachings take place in a specific context. It's the context of zazen and retreat and instruction in shikantaza and bowing and chanting and seeing teachers and reading Dharma books at home, on meeting our difficult minds everywhere, of chopping carrots. All of the precepts, all of this is included in the Dharma path. If it were only just that one thing, it would be confusing and disorienting. But it's confusing and disorienting to begin with, but it would be differently so. So seeing that and doing this fully actualizes it.
And we don't actually just say the thing that you said, which my recollection of it is that you're always going to be the same. Is that you said something like that?
I think I did. Maybe.
But it's an important thing that the mind does tend to go back and forth. I will do this in order to be different. Oh, I hear the teaching, I'm always going to be the same. And of course, one of the pieces of reality, one of the marks of existence, is change. And even though you are the person you've always been, you're really not. You used to have darker hair. So there is something. I mean, this is very hard to talk about because any words that come out split the world into two pieces. This is hard to understand with the intellect. But there is a process of development in Zen practice. It's not just that we stay rigidified in the pillar of salt really does dissolve. The salt doesn't go away, but it does shift and change. And so you can almost feel how it's, if you say that, then people go, but I'm still the same old me. Yes, they're both true. And so your motivation is perfect, as Josh is pointing out. And you're still deluded perfectly. And you just keep living your life, and it happens to be this life, this Zen life. And you keep coming back. And even if the bait and switch is still fooling you, it's delicious bait.
As long as you all provide that.
I'd like to share a little delusion in the form of insight that resonated with me with your talk about being fucked and finding that the vessel is too small. It came up with me last night at Paul's ordination service when everybody stands up and talks about Paul's warmth and compassion and how you can really feel that. It reminded me of Ray's ordination ceremony where people got up and said the same things. And of course, being me, I compared myself to Ray and came up really, really short. And this just proves that I'm uniquely born with an inability to love and be one. That is my fundamental flaw that I've got to hide from everybody because I just can't do that. And I mean, I still got that same salt, but it has shifted over the time. And there were two real parts to it. The first was when I realized I had a idea of what compassion should look like. That my compassion should look like Ray's compassion, or Paul's compassion, or Mike's, or Melissa's, or something else. I thought, maybe I should take another look at that idea that I know what compassion should look like.
And then the next part was I realized I was preferring warmth to coolness. And it's another one of those things where at some deep level I'm coming back to discovering an old, you know, needlepoint slogan, it takes all kinds. You know, warmth and trust are good, and sometimes little detachment and skepticism are also good. And yeah, same old salt, rearranged a little bit.
Whoever is over there being pointed to by Mike.
It's Faye.
Faye.
I really like how you talked about this idea of little failure.
Speak up a little bit. We've got a loud fan up here.
Like Faye's failing and this great failure. And how sometimes even just like going to the summer, I would rather... give like a very superficial... you know, failing answer rather than meet this like huge failure. And coming back to this koan and how, you know, maybe it would have been nice if Zhu Feng was like, Fei really doesn't understand, you know, the relative. He's stuck in openness or oneness. And what if I start there? What if I meet her there? You know, ready to meet this like big failure, and how hard that is to do.
Yeah, that's so important and so well expressed. And that's the courageous work. That's the courageous work of Zazen. That's the courageous work of showing up in Doksan. And it's actually the courageous work on koans too. Thank you for sharing that. Harry, Mike, Nicholas.
thank you for allowing this Dharma dialogue. I think it's very powerful. I said thank you for allowing this. Thank you! For allowing this Dharma dialogue!
A little bit louder, Harry.
I can't open my mouth without making a joke, but give me a moment to say this because it's hard for me to find the words to transmit it. But going back to case 96, as it's called, we're not to concern ourselves with the gears and the machinations that make a sangha or a monastery move. Don't confuse the ascending of one monk or one person to a new position with part of seeking the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. And reflect, consider, be like the crane or osprey or stork or sandpiper, any other of the birds represented. Think of that bird nesting on the moon and its dreams.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay, not so poetic, but thank you, honey. So one of the reasons I really like the reading that we did that talks about immeasurable reality, I really like the balanced view that that liturgy brings. It talks about the limited karmic self. I myself have a tendency in my practice to think that in being caught in, quote, non-duality, in thinking, well, the limited karmic self is all there is. So whatever shows up in my emotional range or thought range, this is it. And of course that's true. But in service of that particular dharma, that this is it, I can also trap myself in this is it. And so I wanted to offer that I really appreciate this liturgy for suggesting that Zazen is also immeasurable reality. That the pillar of salt does in fact exist in a wide world, does in fact is not the only thing that exists. And in a similar service to non-duality, to say that it's not the content of our consciousness is half true. I would say immeasurable reality also is the content of consciousness. And that it is this vast ocean that the pillar of salt dissolves in, which for me is the greatest comfort of our practice and why I am so devoted to the boundless way.
Reminds me of one of my favorite stories of my teacher, George Bowman, that a student came in to him and said, "Is this it?" And George said, "No." And that invitation to boundlessness, you know, so the last word, "This is it." Wherever we are is just the threshold of something unimaginable. All right, I think you're pointing to that. We can get locked into anything. Oh, well, this is it. It's bigger. Yeah, so thank you for pointing that direction.
Okay.
Or maybe, is this it? Yes. So sometimes completely, you know, all of it, pillar of salt.
Right.
Sometimes completely dissolved. Each one, all of it.
And I just find myself getting a little concerned about this pillar of salt, because I'm not quite sure where is this pillar of salt we're talking about. If you can locate it for me, please bring it to show me.
I mean, there's some salt in the kitchen.
One other facet I want to point out about this question of, is this it?
Just checking in with David on something. Don't keep going.
One other facet of this question of, is this it? And we're considering, no, yes. Mm-hmm. Let us not miss that in this moment, what's arising is the question, is this it? And that doesn't actually need an answer. That isn't a special kind of thing that then we need to discern. It is or it isn't. It's just that question arising. Meredith. Sorry. I had.
You've also put in Ray and Karen.
I'm bad at this.
And Nicola. Anyway, Meredith. Just put your hands up after somebody speaks, and Josh will call.
I'm turning over the self-centered idea that brings us to practice, and reflecting on how the structure and form and the things that we do here allow that self-centered motivation to bring me here, which makes all of you co-conspirators in my self-centered motivation, which means that it's our centered motivation. And I was also just sort of turning over how there's a wider world out there that that doesn't do the practice that we recognize as the practice, and yet facilitates it just enough. There are just enough people out there who would never go near a Zen center but think Zen is cool, that a cultural climate's been created within which we can exist. I was remembering that there was a little bit of difficulty with the paperwork. Melissa went down to Worcester City Hall, and at first there was some difficulty with paperwork, but eventually it got cleared up. In a different era, it wouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. But there's just enough respect in a whole culture. So the whole world is a co-conspirator in the self-centered motivation that allows this practice to flourish here.
Brings up this whole question of self, not self.
It's also a really nice description of karma. You know, these endless causes and conditions that come through, and we're not in control. You know, this really strong insight that Josh was talking about, I am not doing it. I am not. You know, sometimes that when I get really frustrated and stressed, I say, I can't do it. And then that flips. I can't do it. That's a totally different meaning of that. And the little thing that you're referring to is this amazing moment when we're meeting with the people at City Hall when our lawyer found a case that allowed a Buddhist temple to have people sleep overnight that had just come into the law office that day from Zen Mountain Monastery, having made a case for it a few years back that had finally found its way into the case law. I mean, that's extraordinary. We couldn't have done that. We couldn't have made that happen. And they all went, oh, well, then,
If Zen Mountain Monastery is doing it.
No, if it's in the law.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
They didn't know what Zen Mountain Monastery was, but we knew. Someplace in Woodstock, New York. Oh. It's just right, amazing. And the fact that we're all here, you know, that we didn't
so
drive
the city
off the road.
Officials said, oh, it's a Woodstock thing.
Yes,
let it go.
They were Joni Mitchell things. We better so, bring this in.
Returning to the people who I left hanging. Nicola?
Yeah. I quote this sentence, as far as dying, spending or lying down, or something that you are not lacking. So this sentence is really puzzling for me. The way it sounds to me is black humor. I would say maybe arrogance. So first of all, is there any other facet to it? Maybe I'm just sort of filtering it out. And to the extent that I'm not filtering it out, I find it even more confusing, considering that he's just caressing the shoulder of, I don't know, his friend or anyway, at least colleague, and he's doing this sort of thing that to me sounds like arrogant comments. So this part of the story is really confusing and maybe interesting, a bit irritating.
I'm just wondering.
I think that. He said that this sentence, Jiufeng says to the head monk as to dying, standing, sitting, you are not lacking. And that, is that some kind of black humor? Is that some kind of arrogance? Like, you idiot? And look how cool I am. And then the disjunction between that and the caressing the shoulder. Mm. That it's troubling and even irritating. Is that... Yeah. So this is the function of koans. This place that doesn't sit right. And I'm sure we could give lots of different explanations, but the teaching about how to work with koans is the place where we get caught, where we get irritated. There's something that's being touched in us that it's possible to be with in some way that's not just, well, let me just figure this out and have a pat answer. So my terrible Zen answer to you is to appreciate the arising of irritation and to invite you to wonder, what could it be? And especially if Zhu Feng, if we assume that he, what if he's really loving? Why would he say this? So I'm sorry.
Yeah. And this is so well expressed, David. And sometimes this thing that doesn't quite sit well has to do with something that's going on in the case, as Niccolò is pointing to. And sometimes this thing that doesn't quite sit well has to do with what's going on in us with regard to coming in and doing this and talking about, as Faye gave an example of. And both of those are the koans functioning accordingly.
And if I may do a really bad Zen thing now, worse than what David and Josh just did.
I got the quick break.
As to being a bad Zen teacher, you are not lacking. But it really goes back to what Julie was saying. You know, that we think, whoa, you know, Zhu Feng, he's so much better. He really got it. And the poor old head monk dies. And, you know, boy, what an idiot. Or, Ray is so warm and compassionate. He's not lacking in that. Julie notices a comparing thought coming up. In that, you're not lacking. You're really disturbed by this koan, and in that you're not lacking. So taking out any judgment in it, it's just a description of fact. And this is really a very Zen thing, because the mind loves to judge good and bad, and it can't stop it. So we don't stop it, but we are a little suspicious of it. The evaluative mind is so constant. It really served us when we were little kids to teach us not to go near the hot stove. Bad. And then it takes over. And Zen is partly an enterprise of seeing through good and bad, right and wrong, so that we can live a life where we're actually not doing as much harming. So we can live a life of doing right. You know, you heard the precepts. How many times have we heard them this week now? Do good, avoid evil. So that sounds very judgmental, black and white, but it's in this spirit. This is a very important shift in awareness, and it really does happen. And it's already happening. It's happening right now. So as for being really disturbed by this calm, you are not lacking. And then the compassion comes up. Oh, me too.
I guess I'm an example of the second thing that you were just pointing to, a case that really disturbed me because I took it very personally. It's been so upsetting to me all week I kind of couldn't comment on it. And I think I got a little bit clearer about why from earlier in your talk today when you were talking about how certain thoughts come up as exceptions to the rule, that you're supposed to treat them like just other arisings. And I think that's probably been the most important thing that's been going on for me this week is moving from doing, okay, this and this and yes, this and this, but that's different. It takes me out of that frame, and now I'm looking at the frame from a different position and saying, huh, is that frame really useful if it doesn't address this? And I keep doing that, and I keep getting brought back to just another arising, and it's really been hard for me because that is the way my mind works. But I think I'm beginning to kind of see it as it's arising, as I'm saying to myself, oh, this is the exception that really takes me out of that whole frame. And I think what I'm understanding about why the case was so intensely upsetting to me is that's sort of what the head monk is doing. He's saying, I'm not going to play this game. I'm taking my marbles and going home, or I'm going up in smoke, or I'm going to show you. But he won't do it, and he won't engage. And what he does is so destructive. I mean, that's what really killed him. No, he didn't go up in smoke. He kills himself. He commits suicide. He says, and he does something that damages the whole community. From the way I was looking at it, it's tremendously destructive. But, you know, if I get away from it being quite that dramatic, he's also, in ways somebody else said, maybe you said, Josh, he really is taking himself away from the community in a way that because he can't deal with this distress and is either saying, I won't play by the rules, I'm such an idiot, or I publicly humiliated myself or whatever, then all the other wonderful things that he must have been and done for all those years that God would be the head monk are no longer available. Because he took this whole thing so personally, he couldn't figure out a way to contain his own whatever it was. I could give lots of interpretations, but whatever it was, he couldn't stay and continue to engage and continue, therefore, to give back all of what he had learned, whether or not he learned that lesson.
Kick out.
There's somebody back there.
This first time I heard that poem, I was struck by that line, passing away in incense, the true bloodline does not go through. It struck me that the adjective true wasn't really necessary there. The bloodline doesn't go through. And it seems to me that points to the head monk really having. The true bloodline really did go through him. And, you know, it was because he screwed it up, passing away in incense, but it didn't go through. He had it. The other thing that struck me was, I did check my hair. I lost my ticket. Can I give it back?
I don't get it.
You've lost you.
Checking a coat.
Oh, he checked. It's a pun.
Gotcha. All right, I think we have.
Yeah, I would just say too much on the sides, don't
you? Mark.
I think it's funny. This koan has not disturbed me until just this moment, and kind of buzzing on the disturbance that even within such a devotion and even within such a clarity to something so tender and beautiful, that there is still you know, you watch the news and, you know, people killing in the name of love. And I think I find refuge, deluded refuge that it is, that if I'm devoted to this path, that somehow I'm going to escape doing harm to other people and hopefully to myself, most importantly, of course. And this monk was obviously very devoted to this teacher and obviously loved his sangha and loved his community and loved the Dharma. And even within that love, there was still this ultimate destruction. And it really scares me to acknowledge that even within a path as compassionate as this, it's still possible to do such damage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And this is why all of our ceremonies include this atonement. And
it's why all the ceremonies include atonement.
So seeing how easily and how quickly even we, with our devotion and commitment to this path and all of our zazen and all of our how easily and quickly we can fall into doing harm. And that seeing that is the root of compassion. And then when we see other people getting caught up by their grasping, their aversion, their certainty, and they're doing harm, we say, "Ah, oh, I am like that too." And this is the humility of this practice. And we don't take the precepts because we can keep them. We take the precepts because we can't.
I'm really glad you asked that question because it helps me to understand something that I've been working with, which is the preference for order over chaos. This is what I was working with the groundhog. You know, I wanted order in my garden, and then this chaos came running in. And it felt wrong. You know, we want order. There's this natural preference for things to be right. But the world includes, our reality includes all of it, the order and the chaos, the things that we perceive as going wrong as well as the ones that we see as going right. Sometimes the true bloodline does not go through, and somehow that's not a mistake. Somehow that is part of the whole picture. The causing destruction through what seems like a foolish act. Also, exactly right. So it's a challenge for me to come up against this and to understand it. And I'm grateful that you brought it forward for all of us to have it.
Thank you all for your coming forward, for your hearts, for your tears, for your sharing, for your receiving. Thank you, thank you.